Chapter 8. Proofreading at 110 degrees Fahrenheit. The Sri Gauranga Press was situated down a narrow lane behind the headquarters building. They were reputed to be one of the best printers in Calcutta, and the Mahabodhi Society had dealt with them for many years. During the 2.5 weeks for which I was in the City of Dreadful Heat, as it now also was, seeing the Vaishaka number of the Mahabodhi Journal through the final stages of its production, many a half hour did I spend in the press's dark, cramped little front office, checking last-minute corrections and signing print orders on the completed forms. Most of my time, however, was spent in my room on the second floor of the headquarters building, whither they came to me in rapid succession, first the galleys and then the proofs, brought, while the ink was still wet, by the Sri Gauranga Press's black-fingered printer's devil. The galleys took the form of narrow strips of paper, often as much as 8 or 10 feet in length, on which was a single continuous column of type. If there were more than 40 or 50 misprints on a strip, the compositors did not know English or knew very little. I sent it back with the misprints corrected and called for a second galley. Sometimes I had to call for a third. Otherwise, or when galley misprints had been reduced to no more than 6 or 8, the corrected matter came back to me in page-proof form and set up in the journal's traditional double columns. First page proofs did not often contain more than 6 misprints, so that I was usually able to give the print order on the second page proof, whether at the press or in my own room, it being my practice to give this only after I'd seen a perfectly clean proof. The press, I had already learnt, could not always be trusted, good as they were, to carry out my final corrections before printing. Time was money. Or even if they did carry them out, not to make any fresh mistakes in the process. Since the Vaishaka number comprised more than 12 forms, there were 8 pages to a form. And since I was often reading the page proofs of earlier forms and galleys of later ones at the same time, my little table in front of the barred window was usually covered with proofs of different kinds at their various stages of progress, the long strips of the galleys hanging over the edge of the table and trailing across the floor. If the proofs came from the Sri Gauranga press with the ink still wet, they often went back, damp with my perspiration, which fell in great drops onto the paper from my forehead and soaked it from the palms of my hands and the underside of my wrists and forearms. On my arrival in the city, which I reached in mid-afternoon, the weather had been very sultry, with a hot wind blowing. Since then the wind had subsided, but it continued to be sultry, and before many days had passed, the thermometer was standing at 110 degrees Fahrenheit. In Calcutta, it seemed, April was indeed the cruelest month, even if it was cruel here, for reasons different from those which the author of the famous line proceeded to allege. I sat at my proof-covered table, wearing only my inner robe, a sort of waistcloth, the coarse cotton of which adhered uncomfortably to the seat of my chair and felt disagreeably tight about my middle. Every now and then I had recourse to the earthenware water pot that stood in the corner by the door, or, more occasionally, sent out one of the society's bare-legged servants to a nearby tea stall for tea. Before lunch I doused myself, Indian style, in the bathroom on the opposite corner of the inner veranda, but 10 minutes later I would be as hot and sticky as ever. On days when the heat was particularly trying, I took a second bath in the afternoon, and even a third one in the evening. Great as the temptation might be, however, one had to be careful not to take too many baths, as this tended to deplete the skin's natural oils, with the result that one came out in an unsightly and rather painful rash. Since it was so hot, I had little or no appetite, and found the society's meagre breakfast of 2 slices of toast, and its insubstantial anti-meridian lunch for the monks of rice and curry, supplemented by the occasional tiny pot of sweet curds, more than sufficient for my needs. Night brought but scant relief. The atmosphere was close. I slept heavily, almost as though I'd been drugged, and woke to the grey dawn light with a feeling of the oppressiveness of existence, a feeling that weighed not only on my eyelids, but almost on my soul. By 6 o'clock, however, having meditated a little and had breakfast, I was seated at my table, getting on with the work for which I had come to Calcutta, at this, the very time of year I would least have wished to be there. The work had started long before my arrival in the city of dreadful heat. For 2 months or more I had been collecting articles for the Vaishaka number, reading them, corresponding with their respective authors, and preparing the articles themselves for the press. Now they were all passing through my hands in proof form, and I was reading them once again, perhaps even more closely than before. As befitted the avowedly international character of the journal, indeed of the Mahabodhi Society itself, the authors of the articles were of 7 or 8 different nationalities, belonging to both the East and the West, and represented, in the case of the Buddhist contributors, both the Theravadin and the Mahayana traditions. The authors of no fewer than 5 of the articles had previously been contributors to Stepping Stones, my own minuscule journal of Himalayan religion, culture and education. After its demise, I continued to be in contact with them, and on my appointment to the editorial board, had succeeded in enlisting them as contributors to the bigger and better known Mahabodhi, then in its 63rd year of publication. Perhaps the most prominent member of the group was Lama Govinda, with whose interpretation of Buddhism I was very much in agreement, and who is now a personal friend. The Lama, who had known Anagarika Dhammapala and been actively associated with the society in the early 30s, had of course contributed to its journal before. But disagreements having arisen between him and Devapriya Valasinha, he ceased contributing and in fact virtually severed his connection with the society. One of the disagreements between him and Devapriyaji was of a personal nature, relating to Govinda's style or distinguishing title. At first, at the time of his association with the society, the future Lama had styled himself Brahmachari Govinda, as he had done previously in Ceylon. Subsequently, however, he began styling himself first Anagarika Brahmachari Govinda, then Anagarika B. Govinda, and finally, after his initiation into Tibetan Buddhism and his marriage to Li Gotami, Lama Anagarika Govinda. Devapriyaji had strongly objected to this latest development. How could a married man call himself an Anagarika, he wanted to know. An Anagarika was by definition homeless and hence wifeless. He was one who, without being a bhikkhu, gave up all domestic ties and civic responsibilities in order to devote his life to the Dharma, as Anagarika Dhammapala had done. For Govinda to go on calling himself an Anagarika after his marriage was highly improper. It was an insult to the memory of the society's revered founder, who had been a real Anagarika. Devapriyaji, who, as Dhammapala's personal disciple and chosen successor, cherished his memory deeply, and had therefore refused to print Govinda's articles in the Mahabodhi Journal as being by Lama Anagarika Govinda, he had once, I believe, blue-penciled the offending title, with the result that Govinda had ceased to submit articles. As the friend of both parties, as well as editor of the journal, I naturally was anxious to bring the disagreement to an end, and for Govinda to become as regular a contributor to the Mahabodhi as he had been to Stepping Stones. Since neither the German Lama nor the Sinhalese Upasaka would yield, a compromise had to be found. David Priyaji's insistence that Govinda was not an Arigarika and that he therefore could not be so styled in the pages of the official organ of the leading Buddhist society in India had somehow to be reconciled with Govinda's claim in his correspondence with me that the dropping of Anagarika from his title would seriously affect his interest in the copyright of all his writings. My solution to the dilemma was that contributions by Govinda should appear in the Mahabodhi Journal as being by Lama A. Govinda. This solution having proved acceptable to both parties, I had arrived at it earlier in the year, I'd already been able to print Govinda's poem, The Buddha's Seat, and now had an article from him for publication in the Vaishakha number. The article was entitled The Buddha as the Ideal of the Perfect Man and the Embodiment of the Dharma. Quote, "That the Buddha lived as a man among men," the Lama wrote, "gives us the courage to follow him. That as a man he succeeded in overcoming the man within him gives us the certainty that we also can overcome ourselves, that we also can overcome our human limitations and liberate ourselves from the shackles of death and rebirth." End quote. But though the Buddha was a man in the general sense of the word, he was not only a man, but something more, something that reached out into the timeless and infinite, where concepts like man and not man lost their meaning. Buddhahood, the Lama insisted, was in fact transcendental, and this transcendental nature was in no way in conflict with the humanness of the Buddha. Being transcendental, the Buddha's nature was, in the words of the Pranayaparamita Sutra, inconceivable and only to be hinted at in symbols. It was not to be communicated by creating a plastic image of the Buddha in the conventional realistic style of Greek portraiture, an attempt which had resulted in the pathetic failure of Gandhara art, which, though of great interest to the archaeologist and art historian, was entirely devoid of religious inspiration and depth of feeling for the supramundane greatness of the Tathagata. In Govinda's opinion, it was fortunate that Gandharan statuary had died as quickly as it had come into existence, and been soon superseded by a new wave of spiritual art in which the symbolic value replaced the naturalistic tendency in the representation of the ideal form of Buddhahood. As with the visible representation of the Enlightened One, so with the treatment of the Buddha's life story. What was important to the Buddha's followers were not the material facts and their occurrence in time or chronological sequence, but the Buddha's spiritual quest, the development of his spiritual career, the psychological facts and inner experiences that led to his enlightenment and the formulation of his teachings. Quote, "These inner experiences were subsequently concretized into external occurrences in the description of the Buddha's life, and gave rise to the most beautiful and profoundly true symbolism of art and poetry, which carried the eternal message of the Buddha into the furthest corners of the world, and did more for the propagation of Buddhism than the learned treatises of philosophers and scholars." End quote. The transcendental also featured in an article on Conditions and the Unconditioned, by Edward Conza, another of the five contributors to the Vaishakha number who had previously been contributors to Stepping Stones. An object, Dr. Conza pointed out, was swallowed up by the conditions which governed its presentation and could not be separated from them. The same held good when we regarded a thing not as a datum, but as a process or event, and considered the conditions which produced it. An investigation of conditions was of central importance for the Buddhist scheme of meditations, undermining as it did our belief in the fixity and ultimate validity of the sense-given distinctions, between things around us. Buddhists meditated on conditions in order to win salvation from all conditioned things, with a wish to reject them insofar as they were conditioned, thereby winning through to the unconditioned. In the articles by the three other members of the group, the transcendental featured only by implication. Dr. George Rurich wrote on Vanaratna, the last of the great panditas, basing himself on the Tibetan Blue Annals, which he was then translating, while Marco Pallas wrote on some aspects of Buddhist education, and H.R.H. Prince Peter of Greece and Denmark on Buddhism and the Japanese character. Marco Pallas made, inter alia, much the same point with regard to the representation of the Buddha in art that Lama Govinda had made. Latterly, there had appeared in the Buddhist world, he complained, a good many cheap prints showing episodes in the life of the victorious one and other pious subjects, which had been copied, as far as the style was concerned, from the naturalistic atrocities which nowadays passed for religious art in Europe, and these were tending to replace the traditional models. It was forgotten that these models were the work of inspired craftsmen who knew how to give form to the symbolical aspect of the thing that they portrayed. The naturalistic image, for its part, stopped short at the perfunctory reproduction of surfaces. The true Buddhist iconography, therefore, is accurate in an essential sense, which no photographic image can ever be. And that is why it is able to evoke in the beholder those genuine intellections, but for which piety would rapidly degenerate into mere sentimentality, as it has done elsewhere. Unquote. In view of the current Zen boom in America, echoes of which had reached me even in Kalimpong, Prince Peter's observations on the relation between Buddhism, particularly in its Zen form, and the Japanese character were of special interest. A psychologist and anthropologist who had recently visited Japan, he believed that in that country the techniques of mysticism had been adopted without the mysticism. The average Japanese, endowed as he apparently was with an unusually liberal dose of fierce aggression, which had at all times to be kept in check, looked upon the Buddhist teachings mainly as efficient precepts of self-discipline, of self-training in perfection, as the means by which one might obtain expertness, which causes a man to be completely absorbed in the tasks he has undertaken, eliminating the observing self and giving him total dedication during action. Such training culminated in a supreme release from conflict, from the ever-present watchfulness of that which we in the West called our conscience. Quote, and that is where the special aspect of the Japanese character reveals itself. The everyday conflict between one's own terrific aggression and one's social obligations is so great with the Japanese that in order to free themselves from it, they seek the techniques, if not the meaning, of Buddhism. End quote. This gave their conception of the Dharma a very special national distortion, at which one could not help wondering. Articles by former contributors to Stepping Stones were, of course, in the minority, though it was noticeable that they were of a more substantial character than the rest. Prominent among the latter were D.T. Devendra's Where a Hero King Was Born, an account of the excavation of a 12th century stupa in Ceylon, and Christmas Humphrey's The Menace of Belief, in which the founder of the Buddhist Society of London, speaking with 30 years of experience in the Western Buddhist field, declared that one of the great attractions of Buddhism was that it lacked the warlike voice of authority. No one school of Buddhism has the monopoly of the Dharma, and woe betide the school or nation which claims it. Most of the remaining articles were very short, being in effect little more than expressions on the part of well-known Buddhists like Alexandra David Neal and Yu Meng Meng Ji, and scholars like Dr. Pachow and Dr. Anukul Chandra Banerjee, of goodwill towards the society and its work. The rest of the Vaisakha number was made up of the journal's regular features, such as book reviews, the notes and news section, and an editorial, as well as the messages from sundry presidents and prime ministers, to which the society seemed to attach so much importance, and with which I could willingly have dispensed. The editorial, which as usual was from my pen, was headed simply Buddhagaya. But I was not concerned only to recall the figure beneath the Bodhi tree, radiant and victorious in the early morning sun, or even to remind readers of the fact that, after 60 years of agitation, the Buddhists of India still had less than half a share in the management of their own holiest shrine, and the millions of Buddhists in Ceylon, Burma, Siam, Cambodia, China, Japan, Tibet and Nepal no share at all. I was concerned with the fact that, according to reports appearing in the press, Buddhagaya was shortly to assume further importance in the eyes of the world by having a Samanvaya Mandir, or Centre for Religious, Cultural and Racial Synthesis, built there by Acharya Vinoba Bhave, the veteran follower of Mahatma Gandhi, whose movement for the voluntary donation of land had recently attracted a good deal of attention and support. The attainment of enlightenment by the Buddha, I commented, apparently did not suffice. Buddhagaya would now be given full importance by having a Samanvaya Mandir built there by Sri Bhave. It was as though one should think to increase the importance of the Himalayas by building a sand castle on their lower slopes. Not only was the importance of Buddhagaya to be enhanced, the teachings of the Buddha were, it appeared, to be improved upon. Vedanta and Ahimsa, teachings of the Lord Buddha, were interlinked, the press had reported the Acharya as saying. One could not exist without the other. Particularly Ahimsa, non-violence, could never have a solid basis without the foundation of Vedanta. For Satya, or truth, was revealed in all its glory only in Vedanta. That Sri Bhave's ideas were not without powerful backing was evinced by the fact that the digging of the well, which would mark the centre of the Samanvaya Mandir, had been inaugurated by the President of India, while the Prime Minister had made a donation towards the cost of sinking the well. The abbot of the Shivite monastery at Buddhagaya, whose predecessor had opposed by all means, fair and foul, the transfer of the Mahabodhi temple to Buddhist hands, had donated 5 bighas of land to the institution, a circumstance which must surely have aroused the worst suspicions of any Buddhist who had even the slightest knowledge of events in Buddhagaya during the last 60 years. I concluded by wondering what would be the reaction of the Muslim world or of the Roman Catholics in similar circumstances, and asking what answer the Buddhist world was going to make to the challenge now being made to the very existence of Buddhagaya as a centre for the dissemination of pure Buddhist religion and culture. When I wrote my editorial, I was not aware that the press reports about Acharya Vinoba Bhave and his Samanvaya Mandir were all bylined not from Buddhagaya, but from Sarvodaya Puri. Overnight, Buddhagaya, which had borne that name for centuries, had become Sarvodaya Puri, the city of Sarvodaya. Bhikkhu Silabhadra, one of the vice presidents of the society and a member of the editorial board, accordingly wrote to the editor of the Hindustan Standard, a leading English daily, protesting against the innovation. But his letter was not published, and I therefore inserted it at the back of the Vaisakha number, together with a note to the effect that we were printing it there for the information of our readers, as well as to show how difficult it was, for the Buddhist point of view, to find expression in a certain section of the press. Besides the actual proofreading, seeing the Vaishaka number of the Mahabodhi Journal through the press meant commissioning an artist to produce a special cover, which he did to a design of my own. Choosing the illustrations, this involved a visit to the Indian Museum in Chowringhee, and finding fillers for the blank spaces at the end of some articles. Finding fillers was less easier than one might have thought, but in the case of the present double issue of the journal, I was fortunate, having just come across a copy of The Path of Light, L.D. Barnett's incomplete English rendering of Shantideva's Bodhichara Avatara, a work I subsequently characterised as one of the brightest gems in the thickly studded tiara of Mahayana Buddhist literature. So delighted was I with this work, and so inspired by the combination of ecstatic devotion and penetrating insight with which the author celebrated the incomparable Bodhisattva ideal, that I could not forbear sprinkling the pages of the Vaishaka number liberally with quotations from it on such topics as the thought of enlightenment, as the translator called the bodhicitta, and the different paramitas, the perfections or transcendental virtues. All this, reading proofs, commissioning a cover, choosing illustrations, and finding fillers, I had to do quite single-handed, sitting at my desk in front of the barred window in my room on the second floor of the headquarters building, with the perspiration trickling down my body and dripping from my forehead. Devaprayaji was not in Calcutta. He was in Japan, or at least on his way there, having left Calcutta by steamer a few weeks earlier in order to attend the Pan-Pacific Buddhist Conference that was to be held in Tokyo. With him he had taken a portion of Buddha relics and two Bodhi tree saplings for presentation to the Buddhists of Japan. If he ever happened to think of me sweltering over the proofs of the Vaishaka number in his stead, he must have smiled to himself and may even have recollected his comment to me the previous year, when the society's predominantly Hindu governing body, having refused to accept his proposal that I should be formally appointed editor of the Mahabodhi Journal, reluctantly agreed to my becoming a member of the 7 or 8 man editorial board. I remembered his words very well. Himself accepted, he had said, the other board members would take little or no interest in the actual production of the magazine, though they might criticise it afterwards, and I would be left to do all the work. So far, no criticism had been forthcoming from that quarter, but in other respects, the little General Secretary's prediction had proved accurate, and now that he was in Japan and I in Calcutta, seeing the Vaishaka number through the press, it was proving more accurate than ever. Devaprayaji's was not the only familiar face missing from the headquarters building. Saranath, the little monk, was also away, so that there was no question of my being able to relieve the tedium of proofreading by indulging in the lively verbal exchanges that had become customary between us. He and our common friend, Venerable Sangharatana, the voluble and eccentric bhikkhu in charge of the society's important Sarnath branch, had gone to Ceylon. With them had gone Anagarika P. Sugatananda, a.k.a. Francis Story, the English-born director of the rather grandly named Burma World Buddhist Mission, whom I had happened to meet on one of my earlier visits to Calcutta. I naturally had welcomed the opportunity of exchanging ideas with a fellow Western Buddhist, but the meeting turned out to be a great disappointment to me, as perhaps it was to him too. Sugatananda, who was a few years older than me, and, like me, had served in the army, was a rationalistic neo-Theravadin, and his constant scoffing and sneering at the supposedly degenerate Mahayana was so little to my taste that I felt no inclination to pursue the contact any further. He indeed struck me as being a good example of a middle-class Englishman of the superior, supercilious type, which had helped to make the very name of Englishman obnoxious to people in so many parts of the world. And I wondered how my two warm-hearted Sinhalese friends were faring in his company now that the three of them were travelling together to Ceylon. But if David Priyajee and Saranath were missing from the headquarters building, Jinnaratana, the high priest, most certainly was not. In the absence of David Priyajee, who was general secretary, ranked as his administrative, though not his religious, superior, his polished pate and yellow silken robe were more in evidence than ever, and even when he himself was not to be seen, his harsh, discordant tones could be heard coming from some other part of the building, as he gave orders, berated the servants, or greeted visitors of the more well-to-do sort. Since I could not in honesty regard him as being other than a bad monk, a bad Buddhist, and even, in certain respects, a bad man, and since he was aware of this, and aware of at least some of the reasons for my attitude, relations between us, though less awkward than they had been, were neither close nor cordial. For my part, I felt unable either to respect him as someone senior to me and more developed spiritually, on the one hand, or, on the other, to tell him what I really thought of his arrogance, his worldly way of life, and his wholesale hypocrisy. He, for his part, probably felt equally unable either to treat me as a junior monk or to be as open as he was in their own language with their other Sinhalese monks, for most of whom a bhikkhu was a bhikkhu, and the question of his being a good or a bad one hardly arose, though of course appearances had to be kept up in front of the laity. With David Priyajee and Saranath away, however, and me seeing the Vaishaka number through the press, we were both thrown into each other's company more than usual. Relations between us improved, and we somehow arrived at a modus vivendi, probably as a result of our several times discussing the finances of the journal, of which Jinnaratana was managing editor, with a seat on the editorial board, and responsibility for subscriptions, advertisements, and dispatch and distribution. That relations between us had improved and a modus vivendi arrived at was both a source of satisfaction to me and a source of uneasiness. It was a source of satisfaction to me because it pained me to be on anything less than friendly terms with a brother monk or fellow Buddhist, even a bad one, but a source of uneasiness inasmuch as I feared that in being on better terms with him, I might in fact be condoning, or appearing to condone, certain unsatisfactory aspects of his behaviour, thus compromising, if not actually betraying, the very ideals I was pledged to uphold. Though Jinnaratana and I saw more of each other than usual, the self-styled high priest was far from being my only source of company. I spent an evening or two with Sachin's relatives in Hindustan Building, attended a tea party in Park Street in the flat of Marguerite Allen, a friend of Irene Ray's, who was also present, where we discussed Tantric Buddhism and Sri Aurobindo's poetry, of which I did not have a very high opinion, and went for walks in the vicinity of College Square with Jayadev, another young ex-untouchable protege of Anandji's, who had once worked for him in Wardha, and now was at a loose end. There are also meetings with old friends like Venerable Amritananda, the young-looking secretary of the Dharmadaya Sabha in Nepal, Dr. Kajiyama, who was still studying with Kashyapji at Nalanda, and Pani Sanyal, who took me on another visit to his father, with whom I had a long discussion on the place of grace in Buddhism, as well as exchanges with a Bengali student on communism and socialism, and with a Tamil student from Ceylon on Buddhism and Tamil literature. The greater part of my time, however, I spent in my room,
with little company other than that of the black-fingered printer's devil, who, three or four times a day, brought me a fresh batch of proofs and took away those I had corrected. Though the Sri Gauranga Press worked quickly, they did not work quickly enough for my liking. Not only did I want to get away from the heat of Calcutta, I was also anxious to be back in Kangpong in good time to prepare for our Vaishakha Purnima celebrations. I therefore fixed the date of my departure and gave them an ultimatum. Either send me the remaining proofs by the 5th of May while I was still in Calcutta, or be forced to post them to me in Kalimpong after that date, which of course meant that the printing would take more time and cost them more money. The final page proofs therefore came flooding in, with the result that my deadline was met, though not without my having had to proofread right up until within half an hour of my departure from the headquarters building. Jinnaratana came to the station and saw me off, as did Jayadev, with me in the reserved second-class compartment were Pani and his small nephew, my universalist friend having decided that he and his young relative would benefit from spending a few weeks in the comparative cool of the hills. Jayadev wanted to come too, but I already had one protege of Anandji's staying with me at the hermitage and did not really want another, the more especially as Dinesh had been misbehaving of late, and I was expecting that after my arrival in Kalimpong, I would probably have to ask him to leave.
End of chapter 8.